Welcome back to another episode of Awareness to Action Enneagram Podcast. My name is Creek, and I'm with my persnickety co-host, Mari Sikora and Maria Jose Munita. This is an adjective given.
I use that all the time.
Yeah, you do.
That's one of my favorite words, yes. So go ahead, Creek.
Yeah, so tell us what that means, Mario.
Persnickety, well, you'll probably have the exact definition. So persnickety means like kind of irritably detail oriented, right? And, easily frustrated about specifics. So in general, but what's the exact definition?
Placing too much emphasis on trivial or minor details. Yeah. Fussy.
Yeah, fussy. That's a good word.
Like, you know, the text you sent me this morning. I'm going to
pick that up. Creek responds at like 11 o'clock in the morning with, oh, this was a great text to wake up to. You know, it's like, dude, man.
Yeah. I was up before then, but.
You rock and roll, right. Kids, you know.
Yeah. Listen. Sleep is important.
All right. I'm getting persnickety here, so let's move on.
Yeah, here we go. So we're going to do probably a few episodes on how these two coach different types. Obviously very broad, and it's, you know, there's exceptions and, you know, individual persnickety details. So let's start with one.
Yeah. Now I'm starting to feel prickly, which is my other favorite word. Go ahead.
So, how to coach yourself?
Well, I have a particular issue around ones that when you're a coach.
They don't need coaching, right?
No. I wasn't going to say that. But it's hard. I mean, you have to try to resonate with your clients, but not identify with them. So you need to make an extra effort when it's your own type, I think.
So, can we stop there? And what does that mean? What does that look like?
Well, several things may happen. One, it's you say, well, I agree with you. You know, like, yeah. That's not an issue.
Those people are idiots. Yeah. And you're right to be the way you are.
Yeah. That could, and you need to challenge that belief, you know, because anyway. The other thing is like, oh, well, I have the same issue. Like, I should work on that myself. And you can kind of start working or getting distracted by your own issues around that topic. And, okay, you cannot avoid it completely. And I think that several times I've been working with ones and I've said, well, I should do that myself. And it's a good opportunity for me to see it from the outside. So there's an additional challenge, I think, when it's your own type that you need to be aware of and not get too distracted or too identified, too close to, because it's too close to home.
Yeah. Hmm. I that's a really, really important point. And I run into the same thing with eights, right? Mm-hmm. And usually what I say is, you know, I can really relate to that. And here's how I've learned to think about it. Right. Or here's, you know, what I've done to try and, you know, get over that or be more skillful in that way and so forth. So I think it helps to acknowledge it. Right. And in fact, that can be one of the advantages of working with someone of your own type that, you know, they know you get it. Right. They know that you understand and you're not judging them, but, you know, you can help them see things differently because you really do get it.
Yeah. What if they bring up something that you're like, yeah, I still don't know how to deal with that. I'm still working through that.
Well, I wouldn't put it that way. I would try to work with them on the topic. I wouldn't say that I have it, that I've dealt with it. I wouldn't lie, but I wouldn't make me the focus of the work. You know, so I would try to stay on top of what they're dealing with and try to work with them on it.
Yeah. You have to, that's one of those areas where as a coach, you just have to kind of step back and be objective and look at it, you know, like Maria Jose said, not get, you know, identified. You said, I'm sorry, the phrase you used was resonate with them, but not identify with them. Right. So, so not get caught in the identification and just say, okay, well, act as if I am not an eight and you're over one in this situation, and what advice would I give them? Because, you know, this is one of the things as a coach is that you're never claiming to be perfect, right? I mean, you know, if you think about a sports coach, right, they're usually not people who were the best athletes, you know, during their athletic career, if they even played the sport. Right. So, so no coaches, you know, should be claiming, or no therapist, or, you know, should be claiming that, you know, hey, I've got it all figured out. But you've got to step back and say, okay, well, you know, I've never mastered this sport myself, but I've helped other people get better at it. So,
Yeah.
And I think one of the good things about being your type is that you have a deep understanding from within of how they perceive the world. So you can relate to them, as Mario was saying, and also say, look, I understand that you do this. And like, for example, with a one, many times the defensiveness that comes up, or that it's perceived, the unwillingness to change, or like the thinking that they're always right, comes from them trying really, really hard to do the right thing, to do it perfectly. And they will get defensive because they've thought about it. They have put a lot of effort in doing it. So they will try to demonstrate that that's what's behind it. They will have a point of view that they worked hard on. So they will not give up too easily. And that is perceived as defensive. So when you tell them, look, I understand that you try really hard, that this is where you're coming from, but from the other end, it's perceived this way, and how about doing it this other way? It acknowledges that effort that it's behind it, and they're willing to do something different. But if you say, don't be defensive, or it's not useful.
Yeah. I think one of the other issues you have to watch out for is to tend to be disdainful of people who are exemplifying some of the worst characteristics of your type, right? So for example, if I'm working with an eight who just treats people poorly, right, is rude to them, you know, bullies, that sort of thing, it's hard for me not to get really, really irritated and
persnickety.
Not persnickety, prickly is better. Yeah.
Prickly. So,
yeah.
Okay.
But it's hard for me to not feel contempt for them, right? Because I am seeing those things in myself and not liking them, or feeling shame or embarrassment about when I did those things to people in the past. And so it can make you, it can make you insensitive and unempathetic to the client that you're working with. So so you have to watch for that aspect of it, not only identifying it and forgiving or justifying a behavior, but being too harsh in your reaction to them.
Yeah. So with ones, I was looking at the list of derailers that can highlight kind of the typical issues that we run into with them. And as I said, some of them are these perceived unwillingness to change, or the always being right. And those, as I said, it might be addressed by understanding where they're coming from, but saying, look, it is perceived this way. And that's, I'll stop here, but I'll pause here. And I think that when we're working with people, it's two different things. It's like what they're doing and how that those actions are perceived. And you need to discriminate between when you need to work on one and when you need to work on the other.
And you mean perceived by others or perceived by
others? By others, yes, by others. Because the impact might be related to, or then a potential negative impact might be related to how things are being perceived, not exactly because of like how things are done or what's being done. So having said that, if you make that distinction when you're coaching people and say, look, you're doing this, but it is perceived this way, so we need to work on the perception. And that might be just explaining yourself better and saying, look, I want to embrace these new ideas, but I want to explain to you why, where I'm coming from with mine. That makes a difference. You know, so But in order to do that, people need to become aware of why they're doing it and also how those things are being perceived. And that applies to every type, I think.
Yeah, that's really, really important. And because particularly if you are delivering feedback to somebody, you know, we always do 360 assessments of our clients and we do them by verbal interviews. So, you know, you talk to a bunch of coworkers and, you know, I had one that I did recently where the feedback was that the person blames everybody else for things that go wrong instead of taking responsibility for it. But he kind of flatly rejected it, right? He says, I don't do that, you know? And I said, well, you know, five people told me you did. So it's clear there's a perception of this. So look, you seem like a nice guy to me. You know, I don't, you know, I believe that you don't do this, but something that you're doing is giving people the impression that you are. So what can we do to change that perception? Right. Let's start doing this instead of doing that and so forth. And number one, people will say, oh, I can do that. Because if you kind of, I don't want to say letting them off the hook, but if you're letting them save face,
okay, yeah.
They're going to be more willing to say, oh, okay, well, I can work on changing that perception because they're still able to feel like they're good people, right, who are doing the right thing, which is how we all want to feel. And, you know, and they're just going to do the same things that they would have done had they said, oh, yeah, I do that. I'm going to try to stop, right? So, yeah, so working on, you know, like Maria Jose said, changing the perception is a very effective tool for coaching.
Mm. Yeah, and there's also the blind spot. So for once, what everybody else sees as criticism, they do not always see it as criticism. You know, so I'm only highlighting, I'm only pointing out what's wrong. I'm not saying, and this is in benefit of the whole team, this is not that I'm criticizing anyone. Well, everybody else perceives it as criticism. So how do we work on that? So it's, and when they see the implications of what they're doing, they might change the behavior because they don't want to be seen as criticizing everyone else. But you need to kind of split up these two things and not imply that their intention is to do a particular thing. This is what you do, and this is how it's perceived. Yeah. What do we want to do about it?
There are things that are common for each type. Like Maria Jose mentioned the blind spot. You know, for each of the types, we identify a particular blind spot. And it doesn't mean it's the only blind spot they have. It just means that it's the one we have found, you know, is one of the most important ones for them to focus on. So for the type one, it's criticism, like Maria Jose said. And they know they do it. It's not a pure blind spot. They know that they can be a little critical, but they don't understand how much it comes across or how strongly it comes across. And, you know, the analogy I use is like when you look at something backward through a telescope, right? And it looks really tiny and really far away. That's how these blind spots that we talk about tend to work, right? It's not, I see it, but it looks way, way, way smaller than it really is or than other people might see it. So learning to, you know, accept it and work with the perception and that sort of thing is important. Now, there are certain things that we'll see over and over again with ones or with twos or with threes and so forth. But you can't just assume that because I know your Enneagram type, these are the things that you need to work on, right? So we really need to caveat this as we start talking about coaching different types. These are common general things, but you have to treat every individual as an individual, independent of their Enneagram type, right? And whatever their issue is, whatever issue they're coming to you about coaching for, or whatever issue, you know, comes up in the assessment of the person is what you need to focus on. But then help to resolve that issue with the understanding that they're a one, and they're going to have these particular roadblocks, and they're going to have these particular mental and emotional tendencies that they fall into that can get in the way of changing the behavior, whatever it is. And that's the value of the Enneagram. It's not, okay, they're a one, so I need to work on criticism. No, it's, you know, they could be, it could be that they, you know, they don't deal with conflict, right? That happens with ones sometimes. And so then you go into it and say, well, this is, you know, just because they don't deal with conflict doesn't mean they're a nine. So, you know, I don't save that only for nines, but okay, I've got a one who needs to deal with conflict. How does their striving to feel perfect reinforce their struggle in dealing with conflict in certain situations? Okay. So I want to caveat that as we go on to talk about common things that we see for each type.
Yeah. Going back to the whole letting them off the hook thing, I heard a concept yesterday of, let's see if I can remember it, but just something along the lines of building a golden bridge for your enemy's retreat or something like that, where it's like, give them a gracious out let's reset this conversation.
It sounds like something you would ask a genie in a bottle for. You know, you get three wishes. What would you like? I would like a golden bridge for my enemies to retreat upon.
You know?
Go
ahead.
No, I was just, the idea of like what you're doing, you're not letting them off the hook, but you're like, I believe that you're not intending to cause harm. You're trying to do something else. It's a yes and approach. Yeah. And kind of believing, showing them of their, I see you're trying to do something good here, but it's utterly failing.
Yeah, and I, to me, that's how I approach it. You know, I truly believe that everyone is doing their best. Yeah. And what they have done so far has helped in some way. So it's not kind of irrational. There's a reason why people do the things they do. And I am... for the most part, and I think there are exceptions, but minor, that I can't even think of, I'm quite accepting of like anything they tell me, because I understand that, I understand the phenomena, you know, and because I know that there are one in this case, I understand why they see things the way they do, and they do things the way they do, and how it can come across. I can anticipate how people might perceive it. So that's the beauty of the Enneagram, the value of it, is that you already know when confronted with a particular issue, as Mario was saying, not because you're a one, I know that this is what you're experiencing and struggling with. No, but if I know that you're a one and you're struggling with a particular thing, I can quickly understand where you're coming from, how it's coming across, and what to do about it.
Yeah. Yeah. If you can't start a coaching engagement from the perspective of this person is trying to do their best, and they're a decent human being that I need to have compassion and empathy and understanding for, then you're just not going to be a good coach, right? I mean, you know, that's got to be your starting point. And, you know, in fact, we talk about acceptance as the accelerator at point one, right? And when we talk about acceptance, we talk about the chimpanzee rule, right? And it's the, you know, the fact that we share 98.6% or 98.4% of our DNA with chimpanzees. So any time that we're not swinging in trees and throwing poop at each other, we're off to a good start, right? So
love it.
Yeah. And I know that sounds dismissive in a way.
Yeah.
But it actually gives you deep compassion for people, right? Because it says, hey, man, all things considered, most people are doing pretty well, you know? So, and that's the place you got to come from as a coach.
Now, if you don't think they're decent people, it's really hard for me to coach them.
Yeah, so you should.
You know? Right. Now, if they're on the edge and they're doing things that are considered not decent, but they're they're on the fence. You can say, okay, you're doing that. I'm not judging your intentions, but it's not working. You know? So what do you want the outcome to be? You're not getting there. You're not getting that with the actions you're taking. What would work better? So you need to be pragmatic about it. It's not about being a good person. It's about being effective. And that's how we approach it, I think.
Yeah. And I think as a coach, you have to be able to separate I wouldn't want to hang out with this person, right? Mm-hmm. I'm not going to suggest we go, you know, pal around or something like that. First of all, I don't do that with clients anyway. But, you have to say, yeah, this is not a friend, right? This is a client, and my job is to help them get better. And in order to do that, I have to accept them for who they are and show them dignity and respect and assume that they have good intentions. Because in my experience, everybody does have good intentions, even if the way they go about trying to satisfy them is not skillful. Right? Mm-hmm. It's that Aaron Beck thing about, you know, he wrote the book Prisoners of Hate, and, you know, talks about how he's the founder of cognitive behavioral therapy. And he says, you know, everybody thinks they're doing the right thing, right? They're just not skillful in how they think about doing that, right? So you got to do that. I also find that I have to find something to like about every client that I have, right? I have to find something that genuinely, you know, makes me feel kindness toward them, right? And for some people, that's harder than others, right? I mean, you know, some people are really easy to like, almost too easy to like, and some people are more difficult to like. But over the years, I've gotten really good at finding something. You know, and I've even had, you know, people come up to me and say, you know, in the same company, it's like, how do you work with that guy? You know, and I say, he's a good guy. You know, I mean, he likes puppies or, you know, whatever it is. So, you know, you find something redeeming in people.
Sure.
Yeah. So with ones, I think that whatever the problem is, usually the obstacle, and we've talked about the awareness to action process before, but the obstacle has to do with, or the resistance to changing has to do with a perceived loss in terms of perfection of that new behavior. So if you're telling them, do not kind of criticize or not just mention the things that are wrong, but also mention the things that are correct or that are right. In their minds, that means that people will relax, that they will not focus enough on the things that they need to improve on, that they will think that they got there when they haven't, and they will resist doing it. But if you tell them, look, if you show them what's right, they will be able to learn. They will be able to continue doing the things that are right. And also, you will be more inspiring, and they will want to listen to you about the things that are wrong. The perfection in the long term will be more. It will be higher. So it's another way to describe or to think about perfection. So it's not just perfection in the short term, but in the long term. It's a new, broader definition of perfection. And that's the iterative work that we do with our clients. With ones, it's like how I keep redefining perfection so that new behaviors fit in, are consistent with that, and I see the value of these behaviors in terms of perfection. Yeah. What I would never tell a one is, don't worry about perfection. You know, you need to learn that the perfect is the enemy of the good, or those things. That will never work.
Yeah, and that is just so, so important. And particularly with Enneagram work, it's so common for people to talk about rejecting the personality type or demonizing the quote-unquote ego or something like that. You have to move people from... you have to create that golden bridge for people to move forward, right? Not just to retreat. Okay. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, and maybe it's not a golden bridge, but maybe it's a nice squishy, comfy bridge, you know, that makes it easier and it's all downhill, you know? But like Maria's saying, you never tell one not to worry about being perfect, because it is the heart of who they see themselves to be, right? It's the number one motivator in them. So you have to help them redefine what perfect is.
Yeah, and when I work with clients, I was working with a one this week, and I was telling him how we work and about the awareness to action process, not with a name really, but the process itself. And I said, look, what we need to do is redefine perfection, because what if I told you that you need to forget about doing it right and all of that? And he just laughed, you know, like saying, I would never listen to you if you did, you know. But when you talk about them, I mean, about these things in terms of perfection, but a new way of feeling perfect, they listen.
I think, too, what we want to be conscious of is paying attention to the connecting points, right? Yeah. When we're coaching them, right? You want to help them see the distortion of the way they see 0.7, striving to feel excited and, you know, to kind of see how that rejection of that strategy can cause kind of this contradiction in them that can be problematic. And so you kind of want to demystify what it means to strive to feel excited. And also at 0.4, you want to help them recognize how they can kind of go into this feeling sorry for themselves. And just so it's a good trigger for them to say, oh, wait, I'm doing that thing again, right? I'm feeling sorry for myself. That's a sign that, you know, I'm slipping. So
I think that, I mean, for me, it's easy, but I try to, for me, it's easy to resonate, to relate to want because I am one. But I try to get that understanding and compassion for all types when I'm coaching. Because it allows me to just articulate what they're feeling. So I gain credibility. And I'm not judging them, but I'm being pragmatic. Okay. So it's like, I know that you're seeing it this way, and it's not working. So what can we do about it? So it's a gentle way. Now, I'm not gentle all the time. I mean, I'm when there are things that they need to see and I need to put a bit of more pressure on them, I do it. But when it's about becoming aware, if they're kind of open, I try to be this way and kind of articulate for them what they're probably experiencing. And you can tell when it's making sense and when it's not.
You know, that's a really good point, Mariose. And so, you know, you being a one, it's easier for you to, you know, put yourself in the shoes of a type one. But for people who are not a one, but who are coaching ones, it can be helpful to say, well, how do I overdo striving to feel perfect, right? I mean, so me as an eight, striving to feel perfect is not something I particularly wrestle with, but there are some ways in which, you know, it is very important to me. And I do, you know, so if I look for it in myself, I can find it and I can say, okay, well, let me kind of get into that space for a moment so that, again, I have a better sense of what this person's going through. So when you're working with somebody who's not your type, find the expression of that issue in yourself just to help build that empathy a little bit. Now, you can do the same thing with objectivity, right? The core quality. You can look at, okay, well, in what ways does the stunting of objectivity make me feel? Right. And even though I might not feel it as acutely as a one, I can relate to it and I can bring that to my conversation.
Yeah. And you know, this insight about ones trying so hard, and that's the root of their defensiveness, a lot of the issues around it. I was not able to see it in myself until I heard it from somebody else. And it was, remember when we were in Doha? And with all these people related to the healthcare industry, and there was one who was married to a one, and he said, like, I can see how hard my wife tries, and that's how I interpret the things that she does. And I was like, oh, that's it. I really resonated with that, but I was not able to see it myself because it was so structural, so non-conscious so it helps to be that same type, but I think we can do a much better job if we try to understand how each type perceives the world and what they're trying to accomplish and why they run into the obstacles and struggles that they do.
I think what you just said there, it points to another sign of a good coach, of somebody who is willing and able to learn from the client, mm-hmm. right? And not just insights about ourselves, you know, our own type structures and mechanisms, but what it's like to be that person and that their type, right? So even though if I'm not a one, you know, when I hear something like that, it's, oh yeah, that helps me understand ones better, right? And so I think, you know, whenever I talk about, you know, one of the benefits of my work or doing the work that I do for me rather than other people, it's the insights I get into people, right? And it's the things I learn from my clients that, you know, far outweigh any insights that, you know, I feel I've given to any one person, okay? So, you know, I think I even wrote something about this recently where, you know, it's almost like a good coach becomes the aggregator of the collective wisdom, right? Mm-hmm. So all these clients that I have, I've learned something from, right? And then it's my job to kind of pass on that, the thing I've learned to the person who needs to hear it at the time. And it might be Enneagram related. It might just be, you know, business experience in general. You know, a client tells me how they work through an issue. And I say, oh, that's great, man. My other clients would benefit from knowing that. So,
Hopefully not from the same industry, but
I'm not talking about trade secrets yet. Yeah. Oh yeah, the patent for their, you know.
Yeah. Going back to MJ, you said something along the lines of telling a client, "Well, this is obviously not working." So, two-parter question: how do you deal with a client that's like, "Yeah, it is working"? Like when they disagree that what they are doing is working. And how do you tough, like give them some level of tough love? Like how do you approach, I guess, a one? We'll just start there, because I'm sure it's different with every type, how you are tough on them.
So you need evidence. Without evidence, it's really hard because it's your word against theirs. And they're the one dealing with those things and you are outside. So I think you need evidence, and that's why we do the 360 interviews, because that is a way to not waste time in like, yeah, it is this way. No, it isn't that way, because that could be endless and really unproductive. So that's how we do it. Now, tough love, you were going to say something?
Well, I was just going to say, we also have to recognize what the role of the coach is. And the role of the coach is only to say, here's my best advice, right? Here's the way I have found it to work for other people. Give it a try. And if you don't, okay, I've done my job, right? And I, you know, it's you know, a tennis coach can tell you to swing this way, and you can either do it or not. Right. But, you know, you still got to pay the coach, you know, at the end of the day, because they've done their job. Right. So,
And tough love, I don't know. I have found tools to say really hard things in a gentle way. So that's tough because it's the truth and it's kind of without any anesthesia whatsoever. It's just very direct, but not hurting people, or not too much. I mean, people can feel hurt by listening to certain things. It's tough anyway. But when you frame it as, I understand what you're trying to do, but it's not working, or this is how it's being perceived, or you're still doing it, and it's not the best option, but I'm not judging them. So to me, the tough piece of it is being very direct with no kind of sugarcoating it.
Yeah. I think we have to be careful with the word tough, the term tough love, right? Because it can mean different things to different people. And some people, you know, in fact, when we get to the eight, we'll talk about the, you know, abusiveness and how they think it's just, you know, given tough love, but it's being abusive, right? So we want to be careful about that. And you have to establish a relationship with a client based on trust, based on them understanding that you are there for their best interest and to help them, that you understand what they're going through, that you have compassion for them, that you're rooting for them to be successful. And when you have established that position of trust, depending on the individual, you have the option to be more direct, right? You know, and some people can't take it. Some people you just have to be gentle with, right? But you know, and for me, one of the joys of working with eights as clients is that I can be eightish with them, right? Because they get it and they're okay with it. And I'll never forget one client I was, you know, who was an eight, and the reality is he was just being abusive to people. He was being an asshole, and I got to the point where I established rapport with him, and I just told him, I said, you know what, you're just being an asshole here. Right. And I said, I got to be honest with you, anybody can be an asshole. And I'm really unimpressed with that. What impresses me is people who are kind to other people, you know, and he took it and went with it. And it was a big turning point in our relationship. But I knew I could do that with him. Mm. Right. I wouldn't do that with other clients necessarily.
You wouldn't do it in the first session.
Oh, absolutely not. No, not in the first session. No. I didn't do that because it made me feel good to do it. I did it because I knew it would be effective with him. Mm. Right?
Yeah.
So, very important. Yeah. So, you know, giving into my eightness was not just me being a jerk on my side. It was understanding that this will be the most effective way to get through to this guy.
Yeah.
Okay. So I just want to make that distinction.
And the other thing is that you want the feedback to be effective. And that means that if you elaborate too much on too many things, you might destroy people. You know, you don't want people to be kind of on the ground with no energy to do anything about it. So I think you need to be careful. And I mean, 360s have what they have. I mean, what comes up will be there, but you could make it a lot more kind of serious and terrible or not. So you can say everything, but kind of go interpret these things and say, okay, so put context to things that are in the 360 and say, look, this is expected of a type three because they do this, they do that, and it's typically interpreted this way. And the other side of the coin here is that they're very good at this. So you can say things, but I'm always careful in not destroying someone with any particular feedback because I want them with the desire to do something about it. I don't want them on the floor dead, you know?
I consider a success when my client is not dead on the floor.
That's dead. The goal. It's a figurative way to say it.
I don't want to feel like I'm walking into Gene Hackman's house. Have you heard about the Gene Hackman thing?
This is coming. This is like a deja vu of like one of the earlier episodes, I think.
Oh, really?
I feel like we've had this conversation.
But well, Gene Hackman just died.
Yeah.
These weeks.
You haven't heard about that? Do you know who Gene Hackman is, Cree?
No idea.
Get the fuck out of here. Oh, God. All right.
I live to frustrate you. It's great.
Man, oh, man.
So do you consume any
media of other than podcasts? Do you?
Just super obscure and unique and avant-garde things, you know?
All right. Yeah. Okay, well, Google it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So in closing, what's the thing that for the coaches out there that it's this is the one mindset that would be really helpful for you to bring into a coaching session with a one.
They're trying to do the right thing, right? I mean, just understand that they really, really, really want to do the right thing, and you just have to find the way to help them see how to do the right thing better, right? Is what it comes down to. Because they're going to seem resistant very often with ones. They're going to seem defensive. They're going to seem self-justifying. And those are all just symptoms of a real desire to do the right thing. And if you keep that in mind, it's easier to work with ones and be compassionate toward them.
Nothing to add. I think that's it.
All right. Well, thanks, folks. We'll talk to you next week.
Thanks for listening to the Awareness to Action Enneagram podcast. If you're interested in more information about Awareness to Action, their certification programs, or events, feel free to reach out to us through the links in the show notes or by emailing info@awarenesstoaction.com.